We should play with Scripture and let Scripture play with us. Well, the parable today of owner, vineyard, and dead son is one of those that requires playing with. And there's lots of precedents. Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, not John, Gospel of Thomas. They all tell it differently and interpret it differently. But rather than spend the next while describing those differences and trying to distill its true meaning, if it has one, I want you to consider the following piece of wisdom. God is a pretty dumb landlord. Let me explain. Before the days of electronic banking, the landlord would send a minion to collect the rent. God sent a bunch of them. They were beaten, killed, and stoned. Probably not in that order. So landlord God, instead of seeking vengeance or even police assistance, sends another bunch of minions who, surprise, surprise, get treated the same. Finally, landlord God sends not the ugliest, meanest dude he could find to, quote the Americans, kick their ass, but his own son, Mr. Pacifist, love your enemies, Jesus. As I said, God's a pretty dumb landlord. Now, the storytellers play around with the ending, but usually it has landlord God instigating an ass kicking. Both listeners and gospel writers alike have this need for a vengeance comeuppance ending, whereas I think the God revealed in Jesus does not share this need. Although many in the church as well as society love a good dollop of judgment, the way and ministry of Jesus was about love, acceptance, and healing. So, yes, I think it's a story about a dumb landlord who chooses to be in the ways of the world deliberately dumb, or rather deliberately vulnerable, offering and continuing to offer reconciliation, cost what it may. In non-theistic language, God is the energy of reconciliation and costly giving, not the energy of judgment and punishment. This reflection is a prelude to the central question the Ten Commandments raises for me. For a long time, the basis for Christian ethics was a supreme being God who issued laws and edicts, then rewarded or punished us depending on our compliance. If we no longer believe in such a God and hold a critical light to any so-called divine laws, are we then ethically rudderless in our modern world? Put another way, what is the basis for progressive ethics? Our first reading, the Ten Commandments, were allegedly written down by God and given with much thunder and shakes on Mount Sinai. A close look at those commandments, though, reveal far from timeless ethical directives, they are a collection of tribal stereotypes and prejudices, reflecting the limited knowledge that the people of the time had. The first clue in the Bible that these were human rules rather than of divine origin is seen in the fact that they were regularly violated when dealing with non-Jews. Commandment 9, for example, forbids bearing false witness. Yet Moses did just that when he lied to Pharaoh, saying the Israelites only wanted a three-day holiday in the wilderness, when in actual fact they had no intention of coming back. Indeed, according to Exodus 3 and 18, that lie was God's idea. Commandment 6 says, "You shall do no murder." But Joshua was said to have murdered five Canaanite kings, Samuel hewed into pieces with the sword a king called Agag, who was kept in a cave waiting his executioner. And God too was a murderer, ordering Israel in two wars to kill every man, woman, and child. The one commonality in these morally repugnant episodes was that the recipients of these unethical behaviors were not Jewish. It seems then that the commandments were only to govern Hebrew intertribal relations and not be a universal code of conduct. The second clue that these commandments are of human rather than divine origin is reflected in the patriarchal mentality that assumed a woman was the property of a man. This is overt in the last commandment. You shall not covet your neighbor's house, wife, manservant, ox, ass, iPad, ... There's no prohibition on coveting your neighbor's husband. And the reason is that a husband was not property, but a wife was. The neighbor was male. His assets were listed in descending order, with his wife being second to the house and hopefully more valued than the iPad. Sexism is also implied in the commandment not to commit adultery. Remember, this was a culture that practiced polygamy, not monogamy. A man could own as many women as he could afford. What this commandment meant was that a man was prohibited from having sex with a woman who belonged to another man. If a man had a sex with an unmarried woman, it was a crime against the property of her father that could be rectified with a fine. For the father had had his net worth devalued by this act, since he could not get the proper bride price for his daughter, who was now damaged goods. So a code of ethics that treats some human beings as property of others needs to be pronounced immoral and discarded. The last clue that we're dealing with the Ten Commandments is of human rather than divine construction, is the code has been abandoned whenever it's been seemed inconvenient. Look around this church. There are plenty of graven images. And not just in St. Matthew's, but probably in every church you could think of, there are crosses. There are stained glass windows with images in them. And outside in society, there are things like public sculpture, billboards, and art galleries. Commandment 2 is historically redundant. And then there's Commandment 3, the Lord's name in vain. A civil contract is no longer required to be sworn in the name of the Lord, so that if it's broken, the offending party would be guilty of taking the Lord's name in vain. Today, contracts are signed into legal documents and enforced by the courts. Without that defining context, most people today think Commandment 3 is about the words that escape when one's toe collides with a rock. Depending on the expletive, these words might be blasphemous, but they have nothing to do with taking the Lord's name in vain. For 1900 years, Christians, other than the small group called Seventh-day Adventists, have ignored the commandment 4 regarding the Sabbath, which of course is on a Saturday. Then there are the complexities of interpreting some commandments that do seem to make some sense in our modern world, like murder. Think of the issues of abortion, euthanasia, warfare, whether it be liberation armies or whatever. However desirable simplicity might be to these major ethical questions, the answer is not simple. So given such limitations on the Ten Commandments or any other moral code allegedly delivered by a supreme being, God, what then is the basis of our ethics? Now I'd posit this morning two thoughts for your consideration. Firstly, the data of human experience suggests that happiness, a coveted goal that most wish for, is found only when we seek the happiness and well-being of others as well as ourselves. Our individual well-being and the well-being of others, both known and unknown to us, is inextricably linked. And it's from this interconnectivity follows the notions of the dignity and rights of every human being, and the notion of respect and care for our environment. Secondly, what enhances us as human beings is not just the well-being of others and our environment, but responding to that which calls us beyond our limits. This is about affirming people in the quest to reach up to and beyond their potential. It's about broadening vision, welcoming new knowledge and understanding, and seeking to create a better, healthier home for all. The opposite of this is diminishing people, restricting knowledge, keeping everything the same, often because we are fearful of others' potential and power. The spirit of reconciliation that is at the heart of the gospel parable today is about the cost of remaining in relationship, for the health and hope of us all is interwoven. None of us are truly alive unless all of us are truly alive. None of us are saved unless all of us are saved. And such a notion is deeply offensive to the fearful who want to keep the world under control and see sinners punished, so they create a hell to put them in and invent a God to do it. Rather, I choose to stand with the author of 2 Timothy, who once wrote brilliantly, "God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and love and of a sound mind." So let's use it.